From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Megan Mack.
And I'm Emma Ray Stein.
Thanks, as always, for joining us for our weekly review of Connections. We'll start this week's podcast with an update from Puerto Rico. A 5.0 magnitude earthquake hit the island last weekend. It's the latest in a series of earthquakes and aftershocks that have shaken the island over the past several weeks. In Rochester, Puerto Ricans are coming together to offer relief and support.
Rosemary Izzo is a Rochesterian that lives part-time in Puerto Rico. She was in her home when her friends told her that a tsunami warning had been sent out and the first earthquake hit. She joined us by phone from Puerto Rico to share what she experienced.
I've been down here since Thanksgiving, and the first one that hit, you're not going to believe it, but it was the first one that was a 6.0, and my doors in my bedroom started shaking really, really hard, and they're glass doors, big closet, and I swear I had never experienced an earthquake, and my house wasn't shaking, it was just the doors, all the glass and stuff, and I thought it was a large iguana had gotten into my house, and it was in the closet trying to get out. All of a sudden, I started receiving phone calls from my cousins that lived next to me saying tsunami warning and for me to head up to the hill because I'm right by the water. So that's how I found out it was an earthquake and not an iguana in my house. The next one was the 6.5. The largest one that's hit the island, and it was in the morning hours the next day. And that one shook my house, my walls, my concrete home. I thought the blocks from the ceiling were going to cave onto me, my bed, because it was just shaking uncontrollable. And then it was just plain fear after that.
Now, after the 6.5, USA Today reports there have been several strong aftershocks even still. So, yes. You know, a 5.0, I think a 5.9. What has it been like after the biggest one?
A couple hours after the 6.5, there was another 6.0, and that shook the house the same way as the 6.5. It's been very nerve-wracking because you feel them, even the 5s and 4.3s. You're feeling them because it's the shaking that you feel on the ground. The hardest thing is the people that are living near the epicenter, houses have crumbled. I have many, many pictures of their homes on my Facebook account, and I have shared it with the DNC. It's just very sad to see the people there very fearful for their lives because they don't know the foundations of the houses. The walls are a lot of cracking. And what you see today that looks cracked and it looks like it's going to cave, within a few other earthquakes, it keeps bringing them down. So you see more and more houses going down. And outside of the epicenter, a lot of the other towns have been affected because of the shaking, including my parents who are an hour away. They had no power for over a week, no electricity. And at 86 and 82 years old, people, the elderly, they need electricity, especially like my mom with an oxygen tank. So it is really beyond what you see, just the people that have lost their houses and are sleeping in parking lots under tents and tarps. There's just so much more going on.
And then on the other end of the age spectrum, you think about kids. USA Today reporting that the largest quake essentially flattened the top two floors of a three-story school in Guanica on January 7th, just 2 days before classes were scheduled to resume after break. And let me also read from USA Today. Puerto Rico opened only 20% of its public schools on Tuesday following a strong earthquake that delayed the start of classes by nearly 3 weeks as fears linger over the safety for students. Overall, engineers have now inspected 561 of the island's 856 public schools, finding at least 52 unsafe to reopen, leaving some 240,000 students out of school for now. Ongoing tremors also are forcing crews to automatically re-inspect schools following any quake of 3.0 magnitude or higher, according to Puerto Rico's Infrastructure Financing Authority. So a very unstable situation. And Rosemary, give me a sense for what it is now like, given all of not only the biggest one of 6.5, but all of these sort of large and small aftershocks. Do you feel like every time you hear a rumble on the street, you feel like you're getting ready for another one? I mean, is everyone sort of on edge?
That is exactly what the people that are living in Guayanilla, Guanica, and Yauco, the three most affected towns, are feeling, like in total fear. Everyone understands that there's an expectation that there's a bigger one to come, because in the last month there's been over 1,000 quakes reported. It's a very difficult situation with the children. Part of the American Red Cross, I've been with them 36 years out of the Rochester chapter, and I've been going to the towns down here and working and dealing with the people. And I can tell you that I interviewed one child that I asked him how safe he felt in his home, and he said he didn't feel safe at all because the house was wrecked and it had started to crumble. And I asked him how safe did he feel sleeping in underneath a tarp in a parking lot, a dirt parking lot, where there's nothing there except one meal a day. And he said 100% safe. So even the children understand what fear is, and even the children are really a nervous wreck.
Next, the New York Times took some heat for its recent presidential endorsement process. Critics say it played out like an online reality show. Others argued that the endorsement was puffed up into an inflated sense of self-importance.
We asked our guests how they've come to view newspaper endorsements and whether they choose to offer them. We hear from David Andrietta, editor of City Newspaper. But first, Michael Killian, the executive editor for the Democrat and Chronicle, shares his perspectives on the decision to remove political endorsements from the paper. Let's listen.
In 2017, the year after the Inquirer endorsement in Cincinnati that didn't change any minds, we did not endorse. I was interim editor at the time, so I was on the editorial board there for a few months. And instead, we brought each of the mayoral candidates in for lengthy interviews. And then our editorial page writer wrote two essays, one on the incumbent and one on the challenger, about who they are, what they believe, what some of their weaknesses were, you know, how they've been challenged over the years. And they were side by side in the Sunday paper and online. And readers could look at what we'd learned, right? And we probably could have done a better job getting some of those interviews out there like the Times did, right? But I thought that was a much more productive and serious way to inform instead of to inflame.
Do you recall, if I can ask, do you recall how that was received by readers? Because I think that's a really intelligent and fair-minded way to go about it. I'm curious.
What I found fascinating in Cincinnati in 2017 and Rochester in 2019, there was no outcry saying, where was your endorsement, right? Maybe a couple stray emails. So it's not even like the public is waiting for this anymore, like maybe it would have in 1936.
But contrasting the idea of where's the endorsement, I'm kind of hopeful that you're going to say that you heard from a lot of readers who said, wow, this is a much better process. I respect you more. I'm glad you did it this way. Thanks for letting us decide.
There are times in the newspaper business in the 2000s where the lack of criticism means assent. So by that definition, it was well received.
Is that what you expected?
I actually agree with that. The lack of criticism means that you're doing a good job, or at least one that's viewed favorably by readers.
And Dave, you know, I think, you know, the Des Moines Register has tried to be transparent because Iowa's always first. They get a lot of attention. The reason I think it felt like a reality show is that the Times had this weeks-long leading up to January 19th, we reveal the endorsement. You know, as if it was the will you accept this rose moment, as opposed to we are going to give you the most substantive set of interviews at length that you can imagine, and we want you to flag them, bookmark them, read them at your leisure, but refer to them because forget the quick sound bites. This is what we need more than anything. But instead, it was all about what are we going to say on January 19th? And that was the problem. I think it distracted from the quality of the interviews.
I agree with you. I mean, where else are you going to get that kind of content, that kind of feedback from Bernie Sanders or any candidate? And that interview with Bernie Sanders went on for however long, you know, an hour or more. And I agree with you. The transcripts are worth reading. I haven't read them all because they're quite lengthy, but, you know, I've read enough of them to get a feel for what they were asking. But I agree with you about the reality TV show feel of the thing. I mean, it's my understanding that, or at least the cynics are saying that it was intended to boost, attempt to boost the ratings of the quote, the weekly TV show. And remember, it sort of had the trappings of a 1 hour TV show, right? It had the, mm-hmm. had the drama builds and then you cut away and then you come back. It was edited for that purpose. So yes, it did have the feel of a reality TV show. At the same time, you know, where else are you going to get that kind of insight into the candidates? And one of the great things that we can do nowadays, and newspapers and all news outlets can do it. I mean, we often lament the 21st century and the digital age and what it's done to print and all of that stuff. And that's a conversation for another show and one that I know you've had a number of times on this program. But one of the things that we can do now is be more transparent than ever and put the transcripts online, not just the transcripts, you can put the audio online. You know, we routinely hyperlink to court decisions and that sort of thing in our coverage of courts. That's just a minor example. And that's something I think that can be really valuable for readers and, you know, doesn't reek of the reality TV show. That's just putting it all out there. I think it was, is her name Katie Kingsbury? Is she the editorial board editor?
Yep.
Of the Times?
Yep.
You know, she said this was the most transparent endorsement ever. I agree with that.
Yeah, I do too.
But it was also packaged in such a way to make it made for TV.
Yeah.
And that, I think that was where the Times fell into a lot of criticism. Plus, you know, not being able to settle on one candidate. That was another issue.
the payoff felt like Al Capone's vault, right? And if they had simply said, this is the most transparent set of interviews with presidential candidates ever, they would have been correct and it would have been fine. And then we would have thought of it more as a podcast that informed and entertained us.
Now to a discussion about the phenomenon that some cultural critics have coined as Megxit. Earlier this month, Prince Harry and Meghan Markle announced their plans to step back from royal duties and work toward living financially independent from the family. The couple cited the British tabloid's treatment of Markle as one of the main reasons the two are seeking distance from the royals.
Local Brits weighed in on the news and its possible impact. In this clip, you'll hear Colin Coffey, a small business owner, and Mark Brummett, professor of Hebrew Bible interpretation and assistant dean of students at Colgate Rochester Crozier Divinity School. But first, here's Sarah Autu, a self-proclaimed monarchist who joined us from London to discuss the positive changes she's seen in the monarchy over the past 30 years. Let's listen.
When Princess Diana died, I, along with practically everybody, I went to my local station because as soon as we heard it, we went to sort of Kensington Palace. And as God is my witness, there was a flower shop in the station. Everybody was, it was like we were robots. We were just going, buying flowers. We went to Buckingham Palace. We went to Kensington Palace, laid down flowers. I'd never seen anything like it. I don't think I ever will. Now, that day, if you were there, anybody that was there outside Buckingham Palace that day, the Queen refused to fly the flag at half mast, yeah? I was there. And I tell you something, if they didn't fly that flag at half mast, yeah, we were going to go and get the gates down Buckingham Palace because there was enough of us. There was no army that could have stopped us. There was a lot of us, you know. So then, you know, the Queen, we respect the fact that she's changed. She accepted Meghan. That's a huge change. This is a woman that didn't want to fly the flag at half mast when Diana, who's a blue blood, she's one of them, died. And she took Meghan in. You understand what I'm saying? There's a huge change. I've been here witnessing it. When Meghan got married to Harry, as God is my witness, everybody of my generation, of my colour, of my ethnicity, we were extremely happy. It was like, yeah, we're accepted. It was a big thing for us, you know. And we're a bit disappointed that the Queen didn't stand up a bit more, and we're a bit disappointed that Prince Andrew is still HRH and not Harry. But nonetheless, we think that the Queen made some generous statements and called them my family, they're welcome. So, you know, I believe in peace and love, and I just hope for the best. And I love both the Queen and I love Harry and Meghan. Good for Meghan. Good for Meghan for saying, you know what, my happiness comes before any tradition, any culture, any whatever. Good for her, because that is the modern woman. So that's what we've got, a mix of the old and the new, and we just have to navigate through it, which is what we're doing.
Mark Brummett, how significant do you see this split?
Okay, now I need to fill the space with noise for a minute, don't I? And this is one where I don't have a strong opinion. I was listening to something a couple of weeks ago talking about how in the US the royals are really seen as celebrity figures.
Yeah.
Whereas in Britain, there's the whole thing that our taxes pay for them. So the people feel that it's not just a glamorous lifestyle, it's a glamorous lifestyle they pay for. So even if you're a staunch royalist, you have opinions on some of the decisions which are made about buildings.
Because that's my money, darn it.
Precisely. So this is one of the things that you do see in the British press is an opinion on the royals over the spending of tax. And when Windsor Castle burnt down 20-odd years ago, probably more now, and taxpayers realised they were paying for a lot of it and that the Queen herself didn't pay tax, that law shifted in response to public opinion. And so I think that's, for me, the interesting thing is that clearly the monarchy is going to have to mutate and evolve to modern sensibilities and the sensibilities of Meghan and Harry's generation. And that is going to be interesting because where is the accountability in terms of tax, press?
Sure. But, Colin, when I look at just the idea of agency and perhaps what Harry and Meghan are staking out for themselves, ostensibly for others in their own family, it strikes me as unlikely that we would ever see a Will and Kate do this because, well, we still have this thing called succession. And, again, Harry wasn't going to be king. If Will and Kate did this, it would be just... I can't imagine the level of uproar. It would be an entirely different level, would it not, Colin?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think if you go back, you know, often people are saying now what Harry and Meghan are doing is absolutely groundbreaking. But I think if you just go back to the idea that Queen Elizabeth basically had to ask her son and her daughter-in-law to get divorced. She'd prevented her own sister from marrying a man who was divorced. Her uncle was forced to abdicate because he wanted to marry a woman who'd been divorced. But yet Diana and Charles were told by the Queen, look, you need to get divorced. That was a far bigger bombshell than anything Harry and Meghan can do. Mm. And I also think that, you know, Meghan is a foreigner. I just read today that she's abandoning her attempt to become a UK citizen, simply because you have to be resident for so many continuous days, mm-hmm. and she's not going to meet that requirement. But I think sometimes we just forget about how incredibly successful Meghan Markle was as a business person and as an entrepreneur. I mean, she was making $500,000 a year. Yeah. She had her own website, making $80,000 a year in commercial endorsements. She's very, very smart. And I think going back to the point of the difference between monarchy and celebrity, she's had a taste of what it's like to be a celebrity without all of the nonsense and restrictions that being a royal has. So as long as they pay for their own life and they carry on being successful, I think most people's attitude is good luck.
We'll end the week with what we thought was a touching and emotional story. For the first time in nearly 85 years, adoptees born in New York State are able to access their original birth certificates. Legislation making that possible went into effect earlier this month. WXXI's Beth Adams reported on the law and what it means for local adoptees. They say the day the law was passed was monumental.
In this clip, you'll hear Andy Thompson and Jenny Thomas, two local adoptees. They're talking about what it felt like for them growing up in adoptive homes. Here's Jenny Thomas.
I call the walking question mark because you don't have that pertinent information. And deeper than that, you're not able to look in the face of the people that you were raised with and identify features, personality, characteristics, those things that we typically just take for granted with our own families. It is very empty feeling. Me personally, I grew up with a Jewish mother and a Christian father, and we didn't really have, you know, the teachings on the fundamentals of either one of those belief systems, but it was how I was raised, but that's not my birth identity. So I identified with how I was raised, but I didn't identify with the deeper complexities of who I was. So it was very much mixed emotions. And as time went on, as I got older, it just makes you feel empty and disconnected from people, and you want that connection. Even if you can just look at someone, you want that connection. It wasn't until I had my children that I was able to do that, but there was still that void of not knowing. It's just a void.
Andy, I see you nodding.
Yes. Until I was in reunion with my father, my biological father, and I hesitate to use the word biological because he's truly my father. He's the reason I am on this planet. Until I met him face to face, I would look in the mirror and I wouldn't recognize who was looking back at me. I had this sense of disconnectedness with the person looking back at me because the family that I was raised in looked absolutely nothing like me. The personality traits were different. When I would interact with my adoptive family's extended family, I was always kind of looked at, for lack of a better explanation, with side eye because I did not fit in. I basically was the, I don't want to say outcast, but maybe the black sheep of the family because I didn't behave, look, or present myself like anyone else. And when I did meet my biological father, it was that aha moment. And having that connection and not feeling lesser than because I didn't fit in. So for me, it's been a struggle until recently.
I know that your childhood was difficult, complicated. We talked a little off air about that, and this is, of course, things are sensitive. I don't want to ask you to share anything that's uncomfortable for you. But growing up, did you always have the desire to meet your biological parents or find them?
Growing up for me, I had this rescue schema, if you will, where I was always thinking about the day that my mother or my father would rescue me from the family I was raised in. You know, something would go wrong in my life or, you know, some infraction I was punished for, I would think, I wonder when my mom is going to come and rescue me and save me from this. Mm-hmm. So it was difficult, but that's part of how I coped with it.
When did you start the process of trying to find them?
I initially started the process probably almost 30 years ago when I was 18 years old. And it wasn't until I actually took a DNA test back in 2016 that I really started putting hard work into it, if you will. So it's been a very long process.
So you took the DNA test, you learned who your mother was, and you attempted to contact her. How did that go?
With the help of what we call a search angel, which is someone who really enjoys genealogy, helped me solve my puzzle of family of origin. And when we discovered who she was, I probably sat on that information for almost a month. I then crafted a handwritten 3-page letter to my biological mother and sent it to her along with pictures of myself as a baby, her grandchildren, essentially my children, and mailed it off, signature required. And I got no response. So I sent a Thanksgiving card, no response. Christmas card, no response. I'm a glutton for punishment, in case you didn't notice this theme here. And continued to try and make contact and sort of put a pin in that avenue and instead tried contacting my half-siblings, her children, and was able to actually get in touch with two of my half-sisters and met them, I guess you could say, virtually through a social media conversational piece. But that, again, was very surface. It was very superficial, that relationship. So it really didn't go anywhere.
Did the efforts or the reunion with your father go any differently?
Yes, that went completely differently. I'm a breast cancer survivor, so it was just before my first chemo infusion in June of 2018 that I got what's called a first cousin match through a DNA test. And that first cousin reached out, and we began talking, and she basically helped me figure out who my father was. He wasn't ready to make contact initially. He was very reticent in having any sort of conversation initially. His sister, my aunt, on the other hand, said, regardless of what your father wants to do, you are my niece. And to deny you would be to deny any of my other nieces and nephews. So we sat on it for a minute and we talked and established a very beautiful relationship. Then my father called the week after my first chemo infusion. And we talked and talked and talked and talked and talked. And we planned a trip to South Carolina to meet for the first time in October of 2018. And that reunion was magical. To look in the eyes of a man who is half of who I am and see me was the first moment in my life that I truly felt like I was a human being and I existed, because I saw him. And with my aunt, I saw personality traits and quirks and snarky behavior. And I saw my daughter in 40 years. And in my dad, I saw my son in 40 years and their connection and how the two of them related to each other. I saw that. And it was like coming home for me.
And that's another edition of Week on Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM.
You can also hear us on the WXXI mobile app. She's Megan, I'm Emma Ray. Have a great weekend, everyone. We'll talk to you on Monday.